Chapter 4. Country women, starting home from the great market of Krasnoy, where they'd arrived at dawn to sell stuff from their suburban gardens and dairies, leeks, apples, eggs, cream, cheese, were halted on this morning of early September as they straggled back towards the cathedral square with their empty baskets to meet up with the farm wagons going home. Foreign militia and a squad of the Paris Guard in their crimson uniforms were blocking one street, clearing another, shouting orders. Cockades nodded between horses' nervously working ears. Gilt buttons flashed in the misty sunshine, already growing warm. Those people who had got nearly to the square before they were stopped in a crowd could see a whole battalion of guardsmen drawn up in rows before the doors of the cathedral. "Don't they all stand there, like red tenpins?" said a broad goodwife of Grasse to her neighbour. "Let 'em stand all they like. I'm sick of standing," said the tall and skinny neighbour, shifting her basket on her arm. "I'd just as soon not be standing next to your goat cheeses, mother," put in her neighbour on the other side, a man in a cobbler's apron, with a smiling mouth, pursed and lopsided from holding ready all the shoe nails of all the years. "Stick to your last, cobbler," the skinny woman said smartly. "Is it a parade?" shrilled the gap-toothed daughter of the woman from Grasse. "Oh, dear little Jesus, remember the Holy Sacrament parade in Grasse, ma, and all the grand gold things. What's assembly, ma?" "How would I know?" said ma. "Do you know what all the crowding and the soldiers are about, cobbler?" "City folk idling," the skinny wife snarled. "It's a great day, mother," said the cobbler, his mouth doing its best to stretch back to normal. "Didn't you know? We've all turned out to see the assembly go by." "Who'd have turned out?" said an irritated clerk, squeezed up against the cobbler by the growing throng behind. "If the damned guards hadn't started pushing people around. I'd be in the office now if they just let me alone with their damned horses." It was 10 o'clock. The people at Cathedral Square heard the bell of St. Stephen's under the hill, the bell of St. Roch's in Old Quarter, but not the great bell of the cathedral. It was silent until, at nearly 15:15 the hour, the whole carillon gave a mighty, hair-raising, triumphant clash, and then settled into pealing tremendously treble down to bass, treble down to bass. "What the devil's all that about?" the nervous clerk said, while the farm women crossed themselves. "It means the benediction of the assembly's over," said the knowledgeable cobbler. "Now watch, old woman. You'll see 'em coming out and heading up T. Pontioy Street to the park." "What's the benediction of the assembly, ma?" the gap-toothed daughter squealed. "Oh, look, look, our dear little body of Jesus. Look at 'em all." The assembly of the three estates of the kingdom came forth from the Cathedral of St. Theodora in the order prescribed by the revision of 1509. The Archbishop and his College of Canons and the deputies of the clergy of the 10 provinces, in order of rank, in robes befitting the season of the ecclesiastical year. Following these, the deputies of the nobility of the 10 provinces, in armour or suitable attire, in order of rank, each attended by a squire, bearing visibly the arms of the house. Lastly, the deputies of the commons, in black gowns and hats of cloth or fur, though not of ermine or of sable, the whole to be attended and duly honoured in their progress to the palace by the royal guard, and to be met and greeted there by the king, the rector of the Royal University of the City of Krasnoy, the Mayor of the City of Krasnoy, and the Masters of the 8 Great Guilds. They went by in their robes and top hats. Far off in the park, a trumpet sounded sweetly. A few cheers went up for known faces among the commoners. The city's own deputies and Aragon, the deputy from Rakava. As soon as the cordons were raised, the people scattered, a few following the procession across the park, the farm women across the square to meet their wagons, the clerks to their offices, the cobblers to their lasts. Inside the Sinalia Palace, in the large, cold assembly room, like a marble barn, the convocation proceeded in good order. The deputies sat, the officers of the guard stood armed at each door. Grand Duchess Maria pronounced in Latin the sovereign's address of welcome. Up in the gallery, a kind of pigeon cut to the marble barn, 20 men stood gasping for air and jammed elbow to rib, trying to see out the 4 2-foot loopholes that gave on the assembly room below. The gallery had been built to accommodate a few court secretaries, not a score of eager reporters. "And I asked to get into this hellhole," moaned Relave. "Pressed goose." He was there with a pass, stamped by 6 officials of the Bureau of Censorship, the Militia, the Palace, etc., and issued to the scandal sheet of court confidences and city gossip that employed him. Frenin had got a similar pass for his Catholic monthly, which carried parish news and inspirational readings for priests. Itali had the pass for Novesma Verba. The rest were reporters for the government's organ, the Courier Mercury, or lookers-on with connections in the ducal court, who had wangled themselves passes out of curiosity or self-importance. Jivan Karante stood next to Itali and watched, fascinated, the chopping motions of the Grand Duchess's long chin as she read her Latin address. Carante's novel, The Young Man Livia, published in the spring, had made an unprecedented hit. He'd become something of a national figure. The government in Vienna did not like national figures, but knew when not to meddle with them. Carante had got a pass, signed by Prime Minister Cornelius, simply by asking for it. The Grand Duchess droned to a close. "It must be 4:30, Relave groaned. The rector of the university, dark-jowled and tremendous, in his gold-faced doctor's gown, strode to the rostrum. "O miserere domine," Relave moaned to him. The rector laid a roll of papers down on the rostrum, placed his hand upon it, and began to deliver his speech extempore. One thin, clerkish reporter for the Courier Mercury was making notes. Itali tried to do the same, referring for help to Brelave, who had been a Latin first prize in Solarii. Brelave moaned and recited Virgil. "Mogitusque, buum," he said. "Why are you scribbling, Itali? It's only mutitus boom." "Moo, moo," he bellowed inaudibly to the rector. The clerkish reporter, scribbling, hissed malevolently for silence in the gallery. After the rector's orotund half-hour, the mayor of Krasnoy rose and made a short, Ciceronian address, of which he evidently understood not a word, reading it in bursts of syllables like random gunfire. Then in place of the masters of the great guilds, which have been disbanded, as had all working men's associations, came the Prime Minister of the Grand Duchy, Johann Cornelius, who spoke pleasantly and fluently in good Germanic Latin for 20 minutes. The Courier's prize scholar took it down in shorthand. Itali desperately made notes. "Forget it," Bellave whispered. "That's not shorthand. He's trying to scare us. It's just hen tracks." "What if somebody says something important?" Itali protested. "Nobody will," said Fredin. The speeches of welcome were over. The assembly was adjourned for lunch. At the Café Illyrica, everybody was gathered, awaiting the four reporters, vociferous with questions about what had gone on in the assembly's first session. "Mooing," Brelave said. All the others shouted, argued, questioned, answered. The four, who had been in the Sinalia, were rather silent. They had known the assembly would speak in Latin. They had known it would begin with formalities. But the day had been a very long time coming, and was half over already, and it had amounted to nothing, nothing at all. A pageant, a fraud. Itali got back in a corner of the turbulent restaurant with Carante. The novelist's good-humoured equanimity was a refuge to him from the indiscriminate and beery enthusiasm of the Illyrica crowd. Carante combined passion and patience to an unusual degree. He was an ardent and reliable constitutionalist and republicanist, ready to risk his already brilliant career for the cause, but unwilling ever to close his intelligence to unwelcome fact. There was a toughness in him that was increasingly welcome to Itali, and it was an endearing quality, that toughness or pragmatism, because Carante's novel was wildly, dramatically, wholeheartedly romantic, implausible, and magnanimous. And yet, like its author, in no way was it dishonest. In the complexity of the likeness and unlikeness of the author and his work, Itali saw some adumbration of the complex relations of the real and the ideal. And he also saw a good deal that made him, like Carante, better, the better he knew him. They drank their beer now, and did not say very much, while the old Illyrican shouted as ever about his mistress, Liberty. Back in their chill, airless gallery, they watched the deputies resume their seats. A member of each estate was to speak, thanking the Crown for convening the assembly. The Grand Duchess's seat was now empty. Sovereignty had made its gesture. Johann Cornelius, slender and grey-haired, with a benevolent smile, took his place to the right of the empty chair, and the ornate Latin speeches were addressed to him since the Grand Duchess was absent. "And since Metternich is also absent," said Frenin, "we thank the puppet minister of a puppet duchess vassal to a puppet emperor controlled by a German chancellor for his kindness in letting us speak a dead language together for 6 hours a day according to the ancient custom of our people. My God, why are we standing here watching a puppet show?" The senior prelate of Orsinia, the Archbishop of Aesna, opened the order of the day at last. Itali had seen him last in Aesna Cathedral on Easter night, a stiff, golden figure in a glory of lights and singing. In church Latin, in a thin voice, he opened the meeting, and placed before the deputies the suggestion they vote unanimous thanks to the Grand Duchess for the convocation. A speaker rose from the seats at the left. The Archbishop conferred with assistants and finally said cautiously in Latin, "We recognize the deputy." "My Lord Bishop, my lords and gentlemen, my fellow deputies," the speaker said sonorously, not in Latin, but in their own tongue, "I propose this emendation of the motion before us. The Assembly of the Nation will vote thanks to the sovereign. The vote to be taken, and the resolution stated in the vernacular language of the nation." There was silence, then an outbreak of voices. "My Lord Bishop, please call for order. I still have the floor. My name is Oragon, deputy of the Third Estate, elected by the Provincial Assembly of the Polana province. I speak not for my province only, but for my country, to you who have met here in the name of that country. I speak of our rights and of our sacred duties." The powerful, assured voice rose, letting the words fill the cold, empty spaces of the assembly room. "My country, my people, our rights, our responsibilities." Any word long unspoken, forbidden, gathers in it all the strength of silence. That strength, the strength of years, filled Oragon's speech. And he knew it, and spoke on unhesitating, knowing also that his might be the first and last such speech made in that room. Up in the gallery, they were all trying to get his words down verbatim. As fast as he spoke, Itali wrote, for he knew the speech already. He had learned it years ago, in the quiet, dark library of the house at Malafrena. The speech that has used so many words in so many languages over the years, but can all be said in four. Live free or die. Oragon spoke for 40 minutes, and when he finished his voice was hoarse, the audience was dazed, and Itali dropped the pencil he could not hold any more. Carante retrieved it and the notebook, for the assembly was in a noteworthy state. Speakers arose on every side. The poor archbishop's eyes rolled. Cornelius had sat quietly through Oragon's speech. Like Itali, he had heard it before. And unlike Itali, he believed its day was done. But as the debate went on in the vernacular, half out of control and increasingly tumultuous, the Prime Minister began to look grim. Enthusiasm and disorder were his enemies. During an incoherently martial and patriotic speech by a baron from the Sovena, Cornelius rose and consulted softly with the archbishop. Oragon stood up again. His big, coarse voice, used to addressing all kinds of meetings indoors and out, cut through the baron's speech. "My Lord Bishop, I request that we return to the order of the Assembly of the Kingdom. Herr Cornelius, not being a deputy to any estate, is a guest in this assembly, without right to speak, unless permission be granted by a majority of the deputies present." Cornelius walked back to his seat, through a cowed yet sardonic silence. "I waive my opportunity to request permission to speak," he said, without raising his voice, heard only by the clergy in the front rows. "Let discussion proceed, please." But the Marshal Baron was now tongue-tied. Somebody called out, "Take the vote on Mr. Oragon's proposal." "My lords and gentlemen," the Archbishop said, "further debate and the vote must be adjourned. It is past 5 o'clock. With the..." A Krasnoy deputy was on his feet. Excuse me, excuse me. I think we vote on whether to adjourn session. The Archbishop rubbed his forehead, setting his archiepiscopal hat askew, and said, I must implore your patience. I have not yet become entirely familiar with my duties as President of the Assembly. I will now propose that the members of the Assembly vote on closing this day's session. A clerk popped up next to him like a jack-in-the-box. Sic et non, he shouted. Sic. Hold on, somebody shouted from among the nobility. Finish the business on hand. I want to be recognized. After a long stretch of amputated orations and confusion, a vote on adjournment was taken and had to be counted. 140 voted to remain in session, 131 voted to adjourn, 47 abstained. The Archbishop ruled that the session be suspended 2 hours for dinner, and this was accepted. That does it, said Bellave. They'll go stuff. Come back sleepy, and vote to carry on further debates in Sanskrit. But when the proposal was finally put to the vote, at 11 that night, there were less than a dozen voices in favour of Latin. A second proposal, introduced by Orogan, as connected to the first, which by changing certain rules of procedure in the provincial diets would give the third estate a majority in the assembly, was shelved by the Archbishop, who had evidently been crammed, along with his dinner, on how to spot subversive tactics and control them by using parliamentary procedures. On this note of obscure victory, the session was adjourned. Itali and Caronte left the others at the Illyrica and went to the old quarter, to the Haleska house. They were greeted with champagne and cheers by George Haleska, Luisa, Enrique, Estenska, and others of the liberal circles. Well, did you declare war on Austria? Demanded the old count, George Haleska's father. The old count, a colonel of the defunct National Army, had held his last command at Leipzig, under the Grand Army of the French Empire. Itali had first met him 2 years before, when he had yielded to George Haleska's repeated invitation and come to this house for supper. The place was very much grander and austerer than the Paludescas, and the occasion had been a fairly formal one. Itali, at his most defiant, had played the didactic republican. George Haleska had been too busy as host to rescue him from the morass of offended silence in which he had gradually and ineluctably foundered. As he sat in self-imposed exile in the farthest corner of the vast drawing-room, the old count had come over to him, walking slowly and heavily, and sat down. "I knew your grandfather," he said, "Itali Sode of Malafrena." Itali had stared at him, too involved at first with detesting himself and everyone else there to understand. "George has spoken of you, but I didn't place the name till I saw you," the old man went on. "You look like him." Where did you know him, sir?" "Paris. I was a young fellow. He was near 40. We came home about the same time, he back to the estate, I to take my commission. We wrote for some years. I suppose he's been dead these many years. He died in 1810. I never knew a man like him." The old man spoke gravely, his eyes fixed on Itali. What was he doing in Paris, sir? Living there, as you're living here. There are a lot of us foreigners in Paris in the 70s. There always are. Polish exiles. Best swordsmen I ever saw. Germans, us, and the French, to keep us all talking. And we talked. A deal of blood and water has run under the bridges since young fellows used to sit about in coffee shops discussing the social contract in the shadow of the Bastille. Eh, Mr. Sordi? Everything has changed. Everything. But we still have the social contract, said Itali, without defiance. Eh? Oh, aye, we do. Much good it's done us. That was another age, Mr. Sordi. A golden age. Milk and honey, before the milk went sour. I wasn't in Paris in 93 to see the butchers. But I was in Vienna in 15 and saw the vultures. It was your grandfather that showed me that golden age, and told me about the new world that was coming. And a grand world it was, before it came. What became of him? Back to his vineyards, and dies there like any farmer on his land. And I had to take my 400 to be cut to pieces for Napoleon at Leipzig, and come home to sit here and watch the vultures gobble. Well, the time hasn't run out yet, sir, Itali said, blowing his nose. Part of his ill temper at the beginning of the evening had been due to a severe cold. He was always getting colds since he lived in Malanestrada. It has for us here. Go to America, you young fellows, and find the new world there with the savages. But don't waste your time here. If there's a new world, it's here. Here, or nowhere, always, Itali said. And the old man said equally fiercely, All right. It's your time, and you're right to say that. The good years of my life were those years in Paris before the revolution. I don't forget that, Mr. Sordi. Though I don't believe what Itali, Sordi, and I believed then. But all it takes to bring the golden age is hard work and goodwill. It takes more than that. But let me never say to a young man that it can't be done at all. He pounded his chair arm with a big fist spotted brown with age, and glared around at Itali, his son George, who had joined them, and the receding perspectives of the salon, dotted with beautifully dressed, amicably chattering guests. Since that night, he and Itali had been friends, linked always in Itali's thought and the old count's memory by that other Itali, who lay beside the chapel of St. Anthony under the pines of Malafrena. And Itali had first admitted a liking for George Haleska when he saw the younger man's pride in and tenderness towards the irascible, frail old soldier. This night, Count Haleska recalled the last meeting of the estates in 1796. They were trying to choose a king then, and went all to pieces over it. Maybe they'll do better at getting rid of the Grand Duchess, eh? He laughed, like a wolfhound barking. Among his son's radical friends, he enjoyed stating the most extreme opinions, outdoing the young men in attacking Austria, the Metternich system, censorship, the Senalio court, and so on. The emotion was real, but the opinions, if he tried to defend them rationally, disintegrated. At their root was only esteem for courage, scorn for opportunists, and the bitter pessimism of a nobleman who saw his class becoming obsolete and an officer whose last battle had been lost. Estenska soon joined them. Old Haleska did not like the poet, but was polite to him, as to all guests of the house. A forced, fine courtesy that reminded Itali painfully of his own father. Others came over. Not Louisa, though she had signified with one glance, as Itali entered, that she wanted to see him tonight. The old count had some records of the 96 convocation, and took the group to his study to look these up. Like everyone else, he had, after the day's unlooked-for triumph, begun to hope great things of the assembly. He and Estenska talked vehemently. Itali listened. It had been a long day. George Haleska looked in on them and had a bottle of brandy brought in with the massage. To restore the deputy from the Fourth Estate. Itali drank a little and fell fast asleep, deep in a leather armchair. The others left without disturbing him. An hour went by very quietly in the oak-paneled study. No sound but the tick of the clock and the crackle of the fire. Louisa came in, moving softly. She wore black. Her mother had died in July after cruel illness, through which Louisa had cared for her. It was a suspicion of that illness that had brought her back from Esna before Easter. She had said nothing of it to Itali then, and as little as possible about it since. She spoke plainly of her mother's death as a release and showed no grief. She had lost the robust, radiant quality of beauty she'd had at 20, when Itali first saw her. She was thin, and looked thinner still in black and rather pale. Her bearing was tense and proud. She stood beside the armchair for some little while, watching the face of the sleeping man. His hands, that still laxly cupped the empty brandy glass on his lap. His face showed no expression but watchfulness. At last, she took the glass from his hands, and as he woke, she said, "Can you come tonight?" He stared, shook his head, rubbed a hand over his face and hair, yawned, and said aloud, "What?" He set the glass down on a table, went over to the bookcases and repeated, half turned from him, "Can you come tonight?" "What time is it?" He pulled out his watch. 2:30. About 2. "Did I fall asleep?" "Listen, has Karante left? We have to get to the office tonight and write up the report. Verba goes to press Wednesday noon. That's tomorrow. Today now. Listen. Tomorrow night, Louisa." He struggled out of the deep chair and went towards her. She did not turn to him, but moved on along the shelves, looking at the titles of books. "I'll be at court tomorrow night," she said. "Here he is, George, the sleeping beauty, wakened by my kiss. Don't you wish you had gone to sleep too?" "No," said young Haleska. "You'd probably have bitten me. All the radical elements in the salon are looking for you, Sorde. We have to get this issue set up so the censor can look it over. Last week they took 56 hours to pass it. Come on with us, Sir Haleska. These all-night bouts are entertaining." Refreshed and wide awake, Itari's vitality was as bright and warm as the fire on the hearth. And George Haleska said, "All right, if I won't be in the way." "We'll put you to work, don't worry." "Good night, Baronina," he said gaily, frankly, using her title as he always did before other people. "Will you forgive the absconding host?" George Haleska asked her, with his kindly effrontery. She smiled and said, "I've been trying to make Enrique take me home this hour." "Enjoy yourself. Do you really think the censor will let you print anything now?" But Itare had met up with Karante at the doorway, and did not hear her, or pretended not to hear her.